There it is. Too much technology. All right, this is forward. Okay. I was going to talk about policy-defined cognitive radio, and I decided we're not quite there yet. So it really should be titled two words, policy-defined cognitive radio. I'm Rajesh Krishnan from BBN Technologies. I am talking on behalf of the principal investigator, Ram Ramanathan, and on behalf of the rest of the XU architecture and protocols team there. You already heard what XU is. The basic idea is opportunistic spectrum access. You sense the spectrum, you look for holes, and you transmit without interfering. The key challenges here, there are two kinds of challenges. One is the agility technologies, wideband sensing, opportunity identification, coordinating use, like etiquette protocols, and so on. The other challenge is, how do you transition this to a new regulatory policy framework? How do you do traceability, verification, and accreditation of this complex space? Why XG? I think we've talked a lot about this today. I'm going to skip this. Our role, we have a unique role in here that the work we are doing is going to become public in the form of RFCs through the DARPA website. Our job here is to develop a framework, the objectives of ensuring longevity of the architecture, have sort of focus the community around certain concepts, and so that we can get input both from the XG performers as well as the non-XG participants, the industry and the government, and plan to release a series of RFCs that will become available from the DARPA website. Our approach to this is to decouple policy from behavior and to provide traceability from policy to emission behavior. And in particular, what we want to do is we want to enable policy-driven opportunistic sharing of spectrum. For that, we're developing a policy language framework. I'm going to talk about it the rest of the talk a lot. Identify policy-defined behaviors. These are abstract behaviors, not implementations of those, that are configurable in situ in the device. And also, we're developing interfaces. The focus is not on protocols. We're developing some interfaces for XG systems so that they can talk with the policy side. The concept, a cognitive radio basically has awareness of the environment, the spectral occupancy, location, time, neighbors, etc. And it's aware of its own capabilities in terms of what it can do and its state. And based on this, it adapts its behavior in order to opportunistically exploit the spectrum. Then our long-term vision for XG is that this thing be policy-defined, that it also has dynamic policy awareness, both regulatory as well as system policy. And this comes as an awareness input to the system rather than be deeply embedded in the system. I'm going to talk a little bit more about, and the goal is to eventually go towards the optimization of the behavior, but first, separate this notion of policy from its implementation in the radio as a first goal. What's the reason? Why are we doing this? What happens today? Today, the policies are in the FCC rulebook. It's interpreted by an engineer, human being, and put into it's hardwired or hard-coded into devices that you use, and they're approved. This works in the case when you have a few fixed modes of operation, like an 802.11b, 802.11b stuff, and so on. The regime where we are going towards is we have all this very highly agile devices that are highly programmable. We have RF front ends with FPGAs, and you can compose waveforms dynamically. The technology is there, the capability is there. But still, what you're going to do even with this is going to emulate legacy modes in that for the most part, unless we have the ability to put the policy input. After all, if you think about what that device is doing over there, the CAN device, the hard-coded device, is hard-coding the policy into it in addition to other optimizations around that policy. When we go to this flexible, highly flexible agile regime, that is not good enough. We're not able to exploit this emerging agility of the devices unless we also make the policies available to it in an agile way that it can use. So we need to move from just agility of the waveforms or agility of the devices to agility based on policy so that when you move from place to place, your device can adapt and work in that environment. So what are the benefits of this? One of the things, of course, is you can adapt to policies. As policies change, you can change, and you can build devices before the policy is available so the policy can be loaded into it. You can adapt to policies changing over geography, that idea of domain-aware operation that Bilhan talked about earlier today fits that category. You may just use a smart card or download the policies when you go to a new country, for example, or have both policy sets loaded and you dynamically adapt based on your knowledge of the location. There's also this notion of secondary markets, which we talked, was mentioned earlier today. The key thing is people who have Spectrum and are not using it may be able to use a model in which they can write policies for the secondary users to whom they sublet that Spectrum, for example. The advantage of having machine-readable policies is also that you can, since it is machine-readable, you can process it and look at implications of it before time. And this could potentially speed up deployment. The vision is that if there is a common framework in which policy is written, and you could build a policy processing framework that is common, and you vet that architecture, then hopefully you can reuse it across a variety of devices. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about an architecture that sort of tries to realize this vision. So first, when we talk about policy, machine-readable policies, you need a language. And the language, this is not going to change first. We still have this vision where the policy will be written by a regulatory body like the FCC and NTIA. Policy language designers are typically computer scientists. They take knowledge of their, of languages. And in this particular case, it's a domain-specific language necessarily. So they would use knowledge of Spectrum policy and create a model for the language and representation. They'll also create tools. Hopefully what we can then do is take the policies that are being generated by the regulatory bodies and translate them and put them in a machine-readable form and make it available in a public repository from which it could be processed, reprocessed, and loaded onto devices if necessary. The device then accesses this policy, and it already has, in my first diagram, I showed that it has awareness of the environment, and based on policy and the environment, it's going to decide which Spectrum opportunities are valid to use and which ones it want to use in order to optimize or in order to, in order to establish communications in the first place. This is sort of just to give a flavor of the different tools we are using and how we are going about it. We have decided to leverage knowledge engineering and semantic web in this effort largely. What we are doing is we are building on DAML and we are transitioning to OWL. If you're not familiar with the DAML and OWL are basically the OWL being the successor to DAML is the building block of the semantic web. The idea being traditionally you encoded your information models deep in your application, and in this case what you do instead is you pass your information models along in an ontological framework on which you can extend. Once you have the policy, I can actually talk about more what I expect, what we expect is in the spring there will be an RFC which would tentatively in the spring timeframe, there should be an RFC which is describing all this and should be publicly available. So I'm moving on to, once you have the policy, what you do? That is where I believe most of the challenges is. It is useful to agree on a language or a couple of languages in order to get everybody focused on. But once you have that language, what you do with it is the more interesting challenge. Basically what we see is that one of the things you have to do is you have to get the relevant policies from a huge repository that are relevant for your current situation and for your current device. You need to interpret and reason about these policies based on the current state of the system and infer valid opportunities and behaviors. And finally, once you choose your behaviors and the specific opportunity in which you want to transmit, you need to check for conformance, whether the specific use in which, the specific way in which you want to use the Spectrum conforms to the regulatory policy. A little bit more about how this policy regime is slightly different from how we are used to thinking about policy, say, in the internet network sense. We think in terms of policy really being a strategy that you've encoded, your multiple strategies, and use this strategy or that strategy as policy. But here, that's not what policy is. Policy is something which it really does not tell the device do this or do that. It actually, it specifies what is valid use of Spectrum in the case of Spectrum regulation. So a bit different from routing policy where there are some constraints, but for the most part you can tell the radio what to do or tell the device what to do or not. So we feel that a declarative or a rule-based approach works best here rather than a program having your policy. There's more reason why we feel that way. Get to it in a minute. The other thing that I want to mention about is once we go to this highly agile environment where the device doesn't come with a canned predetermined waveform. It dynamically composes its waveform and beamform. It doesn't make sense to describe opportunity or what is the opportunity or how, what exactly is it that you're doing to use the spectrum anymore. You're only establishing guidelines or limits or envelopes as to what is acceptable. You're not talking in terms of specific that here is an 802.11 opportunity. That's the near term, but over the long term, it's going to be envelopes of a multidimensional parameter space into which you're allowed to operate in. So it becomes increasingly difficult to specify those for each device and still have the nice feature that you write policy once for a large class of devices. So there is this decoupling that policy, it only tells you what is valid use in a general sense. System policy, however, what we are traditionally used to think about, does not have those restrictions. It can be simple or complex. But the consequence of this is we need a clearly demarcated boundary to check conformance that you use commonly. And I have one such here, and a notional architecture, where the gray portions are ones which are the, let me go top down. What's on the left-hand side is two blocks where you see the system reasoner and policy reasoner. Those are the ones that process policy, and they perform the function of identifying opportunities for the XG device, which classically deals with a bunch of parameters that you have. It has two parts. One is an accredited portion, which is in gray, which is to say critical things that you want to trust in the radio. The radio makes a measurement and reports a value. That part you want to verify and be sure that that is true. And there is another part where you have a lot of room for innovation and improvement of performance. So the gray portions are the ones which are dealing with accreditation and policy conformance. And the white portions are ones which deal with the system optimization. And this architecture, the system, I had gone with the eventual notion of an ontological approach where the system does reasoning based on a bunch of requirements, but it doesn't need to be. The policy-based device opportunity identification could be very simple to get started. For example, you could have a policy conformance checking in the lower part, which needs to read the policy, and the upper part need not even be, need not even know what, how to process those constraints in a constraint language or so. It could be simple. You could pick from a set of known solutions. Initially, anyway, there are a few canned behaviors that you're going to use. The other thing is that that part could be distributed. For example, that functionality could consult a spectrum broker in order to get opportunities. So why this architecture and why we think this might be a good way to think about this problem? We put the device-independent conformance validation part within the accreditation boundary, the implementations of the parameters and methods which are device-specific also within the accredited portion, and outside the accredited portion, what we're planning to put are things like opportunity identification. What is an opportunity for a given device? Like, do you want to use a bandwidth which is like 10 megahertz wide or 5 megahertz wide? Do you want to operate in a narrow band mode? What do you want to do? That is system specific. And all the protocol innovations and system software are also outside this boundary. So this architecture gives this clean separation between what system policy, where innovation can go, and there is this the portion which is shaded, which is ones which is within the regulatory purview. A particular feature of this is normally when you think in terms of software radio, you write a software for a particular device, and then that implements the policy, and the entire software needs to be vetted for each device configuration. And as policy changes, you write another software and you need to do it again. In this mode, what you can do is you need to vet your policy, you need to vet the device. Instead of doing the M by N problem for each device configuration and each policy set, you do an accreditation and verification. You could instead do verify the reasoner once, validate each policy set, and accredit the parameters and methods in the device once per device. So you get the M plus N rather than M times N operations for accreditation. So some intuition on why I think this might be a good architecture to think about how policy interacts with the reasoning. Once you have a valid opportunity, which is defined in terms of parameters, and you say that this conforms to your policy, testing whether that is really so is an easy operation. It might be just plugging in and evaluating Boolean expressions. On the other hand, given a bunch of constraints, determining a solution that fits all those constraints could be a very hard problem and may have to search and prune a combinatorial decision space, but there could be fast heuristic optimizations you can do. If you try to enumerate all the solutions that you have for a given radio, now that is intractable. It's a really hard problem. Therefore, it makes sense to divide these, take the optimization separately, get the conformance part right first, have a common framework in which the constraints can be expressed, and go from there. Summary. I think XG paves the way for policy-defined cognitive radio networking. The key point here is that it harnesses the agility of reconfigurable radios within a policy framework. There are other innovations and system concepts that we have, and they're going to come. We have identified some abstract behaviors. I was going to be a short talk, so I didn't really talk about all that today. But I think the following is useful. What are the hard problems? Cognitive optimization of the device operation under policy constraints. It's a very hard problem. Earlier, what happened was you had a policy deeply embedded inside your device. Now you take that out, and there is this piece outside that's going to tell the radio yes or no. Very, very hard problem. You want to optimize in this. So initially, I believe it won't be in a vacuum. You'll have a mirror of the policy outside and inside. The device will be optimized to implement certain policies. But as we go across, eventually in the spectrum, the device will adapt according to the policy inputs from the outside based on its dynamic composition of waveform and beamform. Now, building agile solutions that are also robust and interference avoiding, that's a hard problem. You know how to do the agile solutions. It's not just more agility. You want agility which is harnessed. That's the hard problem, not new ways to do agility. Well, it's not to say that there aren't no interesting or very hard problems in creating new agility, but I think the system view or concept in this space is combining the two. Checking policy implications for device performance in advance, very difficult problem because it's a combinatorial space and all those situations what the policy interactions are going to be, especially when you have these highly agile devices, modeling given a policy, that's a very hard problem. There is always room for clever protocols to identify, disseminate, and use opportunities. That has to be a part of the overall system, and I think just focusing on that would not quite reach the goal, in my opinion. Like, for example, there are fun problems in how do you bootstrap coordination channels, neighbor discovery, and so on in this highly dynamic environment. You don't know where your peer is tuned to at this point. So you need mechanisms by which, like rendezvous protocols, etiquettes, and so on. There are interesting problems to solve there. I want to leave people with this thought that this is really a multidisciplinary research problem. Like, there is a problem here that everyone is, a problem closest to everyone's heart in isolation, but thinking about it more in the system context, and in particular, this challenge of combining the disparate EE and CS domains, there is this notion of cognitive operation, there is this notion of reasoning, there is this notion of agility in waveforms, and then mobile networking, and the performance aspects of mobile networking versus the algorithmic aspects of mobile networking. And combining all this together and putting them in a system, it's really a hard challenge. So in my opinion, I think multidisciplinary teams is the only way to go here. With that, I conclude my talk. Take questions. There is some more information on those sites.
Any questions? Well, in the interest of time, we'll move ahead here. Mark McHenry is next. You can hand that over. All.
Mark will say nice things about working at DARPA, right?
Greatest place to work. Crazy. If you get a chance to work at DARPA, then go there. Is that good enough, Preston?
That's great. Mark started a program I've actually inherited. Fourth PM on it?
Actually,
did
I tell her that
worked with an NGO? Okay, see? See, yeah, you enjoyed it, didn't you?
How do you advance the slide here?
So that one's advanced, that one's back. Don't
okay.
touch that bottom one.
Okay.
That's another wrong mode.
Now, my name is Mark McHenry. I work at Shared Spectrum Company. I'm going to give you an overview of, it says Frequency Agile Radio, which is our, there's cognitive radio, there's smart radios, and there's Frequency Agile. We're just focusing on some aspects of cognitive radio. This is the agenda, just one slide on what the company is about, what we're doing, and then we'll talk about what, you know, our focus on the frequency agile technology, what some of the issues are, some of the behaviors. And then we did a lot of spectrum occupancy measurements. And I think everyone should agree that the occupancy is very low. And if you're doubtful about the evidence, I'm going to show a couple plots, but come see me later if you need more evidence. But the occupancy is very low. And then the last issue is noise measurements. Eventually, we're going to end up being noise. These frequency agile radios will be noise to the people that are already out there. And so we really need to understand the noise environment to see how we fit in. Shared Spectrum Company, our main focus is this technology of XG and frequency agile radios. But we also do RF work and build circuit boards and do field tests and do a variety of other things. So we do simulations, field tips, and prototyping. Okay, this talks a little bit, this is kind of my views of frequency agile radios. First, our focus is you're dealing with uncooperative radios, and you want to get in there and not cause them interference. There's other aspects where you're sharing the spectrum cooperatively or semi-cooperatively, but we're on the problem of this guy doesn't know I'm out there, he doesn't want to know I'm out there, I have no connection with him, and I want to share his band. And we want to be so successful that he basically doesn't see us at all. We create insignificant interference. And we think this is going to lead to a new regulatory framework, basically where you'll need to talk to the primary guys. In fact, we see a way where this will all be unlicensed, except you're really going to have to license the system, because one cognitive radio by itself doesn't do very well. But a network of cognitive radios is very, very, the performance goes way up as a network. So we envision this first, the certification and approval will be on a system basis, not on a radio by radio basis. Another big issue is you have to assure service to someone. No one's going to buy a radio that only works 90% of the time. When you turn it on, it's got to work and provide service 99 and some number of nines after that. So you have to operate multiple bands. So there's a lot of RF challenges and being able to operate in multiple bands. And then in the end, you know, who cares about this? I don't know who the speaker was about the gadget with 50 buttons only used three. I guess it was Ed. When we brief this to investors and so forth, they kind of say, well, who cares? Why bother? And the real advantage isn't really spectrum use, because most companies that own spectrum, they're not really running out of spectrum. We think the big benefit in the end will be this link range, being able to operate in the lower bands and being able to penetrate walls and mountains and so forth. But you get both of these. And then the thing that Preston talked about is being able to go into Germany or Iraq and have capacity without having 6 months of planning will be the other major benefit. This shows kind of the first order spectrum sharing behavior, which is, we call it the receive only or listen before talk. And it's worth thinking about it just for a few minutes, because this is kind of the fundamental idea. There's a step-by-step process, what goes on. And the scenario is there's two primary radios, which is, we use that as someone that owns a spectrum, and you can't bother them. And then the secondary, or the XG transceiver, whatever you call it, is listening. And he listens to both of them, and he measures the amplitude that each of them send. Well, first he assumes he knows the transmit power. Then he measures the receive power, and the difference is the propagation loss. It's pretty straightforward. If they both transmit and you listen long enough, you will get the minimum propagation loss to either one of the nodes, and then you just run through a simple equation. I know how much I can transmit, and I can cause them any interference temperature I so pick. And it's just fundamental physics. It's reciprocity, that the link going one way is the same going as the other. So to us, it seems, you know, very probable this is going to work. I mean, there's always scenarios where you know they transmit on different frequencies or they don't receive or something. But boy, in the cases where they transmit and receive on the same frequency, it's going to work, and it's going to work really well. Now you look at some of these side cases. What if they don't transmit? People went on about the TV band. Well, the TV transmitters don't transmit. So how do you know that they're there? Well, if you go through the analysis and you look, well, I still listen and learn something. What do I know about something farther away? You go through the math, and it doesn't work as well as the other one, but it still works. And this is, the FCC is pushing this in the TV band now, the listen and unlicensed band and the TV. They have an approach like that they're talking about. Then there's the other approach, which is purely geographic-based, that the primary guys are over here, and I'm over there, and I know my position, I know their position, and I can either use a beacon to find my position or GPS. We've done a lot of patent searches. You could be connected to a phone line, and you know the phone line's position, and if they can call into you on that phone line, then you know where you're at. And then you just go to a database, and this was maybe the BBN kind of hit about this a little bit. Then you could just calculate how much you could transmit and go. And that would actually harvest a lot of spectrum. I wouldn't poo-poo that. That actually works pretty well in a lot of bands. So what are the challenges in this? Preston had some challenges. First of all, these behaviors really aren't worked out. So the first challenge is, what actions would the radio take step by step? You have to be able to detect below the noise level in some cases. And getting high sensitivity detection with a cheap radio is hard. Then once you figure out what's good for you, all your buddies have to agree, and that's not easy. The whole negotiation process is hard. And then you have lots of choices, what channel to do. There's a lot of resource allocation issues. And then security, I mean, the FCC might say you can't go to this channel, you can't on this one. How do you control what people will do? And then this whole issue of integrating with a market system. And I don't think any of these are well done. I mean, there's nothing in the literature on any of these that we really find. Little bits and pieces, but this is all new areas. This is the next part of the talk, which is spectrum occupancy is very low. And if you look at the Spectrum Policy Task Force, they make the comment that the issue is access and not capacity. This kind of says the same thing, but they talk about command and control is limiting the access, but the problem is really access and not capacity. So we recognized that a few years ago, and we started several campaigns. We did measurements for Preston and for ourselves, and we have measurement after measurement showing that in some bands you can't measure anyone. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of megahertz. You can't measure anybody, especially in any rural areas. And some have low occupancy, and then there's some with high. Cell phone bands have high, FM band has high. And this is an example measurement. This is 2 hours of data sitting in one spot up in Washington, D.C. on a roof, 700 to 800 some odd megahertz. This is the maximum signal received over the two-hour period. And there's a dotted line there. If the signal crosses the dotted line, we put a dot here. So this is time running this way and frequency this way. And that spectrum is probably worth billions of dollars because it penetrates buildings well, and it's hardly being used. And it's just this whole idea of spectrum management, there really is a pony in there, because we're going to harvest all this in 10 years, and it'll be a good thing. And here's kind of a high utilization example. This is your cell phone band. And you see the base stations, which you have good line of sight to. And then you have the cell phones, the uplinks. And they have lower occupancy, but you have to be careful, because they're kind of a hidden node to you. If you would transmit, because I saw the cell towers, if I transmit, see the cell towers are listening here. And since I can see the cell towers, I would probably jam the cell towers. So just looking at spectrum occupancy measurements, you can get misled. So you have to kind of go band by band on what the story is. But this is an example of high occupancy. There is some bands with high occupancy.
Can you tell me what do you use to measure this?
There's no magic here. It's a spectrum analyzer. It's well shielded with preamplifiers and filters and an omni antenna. And that's just MATLAB plotting it. I'm going backwards again, aren't I? So we come to the last point, and in the end, the agile radio will produce some level of noise. And if you read through the FCC filings, if someone makes a tenth of a nanohertz or dB of noise to someone that owns a spectrum, they fight to the death, and they have concrete arguments showing that, you know, that 1 dB noise figure, double the size of my cell phones, and you know, how many people are going to want double the size cell phones? And they go down this path of gloom and doom. And so the community really needs to have a big knowledge of the noise in all these bands to show that what we're doing is so far below what you're out there due to toasters and microwave ovens and gas generators that, you know, you're arguing from a property rights viewpoint and not from a the impact to your system. Because I don't think they really own the spectrum, but they don't want to have their system damaged. They have rights for that at least. So we want our radios to have, you know, minimal noise, but there are very many noise sources. It's very complicated, and you know, they've done measurements in the past, but they're hard to apply now. Because someone says, well, I'm on a cell tower. Those measurements made 30 years ago weren't on a cell tower, so they're irrelevant. He pulls up his measurements of no noise, and you go down a losing path. So we're very interested in understanding these noise sources. We think that you're usually dominated by one or two nearby devices, and so the issue is, well, how often does that happen? And then we should build a model that will allow scaling to many, many environments, well, that can measure many, many environments. And this is an example in our office. We took channel 4, TV channel 4, and I don't know if you know TV signals. That's the video carrier, there's the audio carrier, and there's tons of crap in there. And if you looked at TV signals, you would recognize that's not TV. It's all the noise from our office, the computers, all types of stuff. And we actually have a directional antenna now. We're starting this process of, well, what are these noise sources so we can scale to other environments. So the point is, eventually we could go to TV channel 4 and say, you know, 92% of your places, you have this horrendous noise. You know, we're 30 dB below that. You know, you have no reason to complain that we're here. And this, we have a small project with NSF to do this, this team with the University of Kansas, Stevens Institute, with a rotating antenna and trying to identify the noise sources and eventually try to come up with this parametric model. So, and this is kind of the summary. Our company is focused on these frequency agile radios, and we think it's going to be a very big deal because there are a lot of spectrum available, but it's going to take kind of this new regulatory framework. How do you make rules that do all this new stuff? It offers tremendous benefits to society in terms of capacity and link range and being able to immediately set up, you know, for FEMA or for the military to immediately get spectrum. It offers a lot of advantages. There's many ways to do it. Every band has a different approach. And in the end, we were shocked how low this is. Even on top of a building with good line of sight, you might get 10% coverage below gigahertz or spectrum use. So there is really a pony in all this. So that's the mile a minute to speak. Any questions?
Is the trend of low frequency utilization going to remain or is it going to change in the future?
The low frequency utilization, what do you mean?
Yeah, like your conclusion is that the utilization is very low. And that's what you measure today. But as they go forward, is that going to change?
Well, I'm sure more and more people will use wireless. I think utilization will go up. But it can't go up with the present way it's managed. This is, I think, the only way there's going to be that much more utilization is these smart radios. Well, that will use less TV spectrum in the end. That's the FCC's goal, is kind of cut in half or some amount.